become an ungrateful dick. Here are some tips I hope will help. 1. Tame that mane. You are half Puerto Rican, which means that you have a great chance of inheriting my gloriously thick, shiny head of hair, coupled with this enviable gift are strong, defined eyebrows. Women around the world spend exorbitant amounts of money to create the illusion of what you have been naturally given. But don't get cocky, for it is not just a gift, but also a curse. Did you think your dark tresses would just contain themselves to your shiny mane? No, this hair has been passed down from generation to generation because it is powerful, and it is determined to take over your entire body. So to avoid ever being confused with a small bear cub, I want you to investigate body hair bleach at a very early age. Don't even bother waxing. This hair cannot be killed, only pacified. You should, however, tweeze your eyebrows early and often, as you will find that throughout the day, you will inexplicably respawn a unibrow. This ability is both useful when the hair on your head is long enough to fall in a rich cascade to the small of your back within 7 days of cutting it to your jawline, and horrifying when by lunchtime your eyebrows are seemingly the first step in a full body transformation into a werewolf. 2. Your skin hates you. While you watch whatever is on MTV in your generation, I'm assuming something about pregnant teenage wolves getting scammed through Facebook, you will see commercials that would lead you to believe that acne is something you can conquer while singing pop songs into a shampoo bottle as you shower. This is a lie. Unfortunately, being born into a family rife with hormonal eccentricities means that acne is not something you will be able to throw a delightfully scented wash at and call it a day. That would be like sharpening a chopstick and bringing it to a gunfight. Acne is packing an Uzi. You come from a lineage of troubled skin, I assume because one of your ancestors killed acne's wife and acne is still avenging her. Please demand I take you to a highly skilled dermatologist the second you feel puberty knocking on the door, which brings us to 3. 3. You're not dying, you just got your period. My mother firmly believed that if she did not educate my sister and me about our bodies, we would simply never hit puberty. It is because of this blissful ignorance that at the age of 13, I stormed into the school nurse's office shouting, "I think I've been shot!" Upon further inspection, I realized that a tiny silent assassin had not made her way into my Ninja Turtle briefs, but I did just start my first period. So let's plan that somewhere between the ages of 9 and 13, you and I will thoroughly discuss the war your maturing female body will wage on you. My mother believed tampon use was a virginity litmus test, as its insertion clearly meant a hymen was no longer guarding the perimeter, and birth control pills were basically a license to fuck. Note to self, license to fuck, possible title of next book. That methodology is nonsense. It is okay to embrace maturity if it means sparing yourself inconvenience and pain. You are going on the pill the second that first egg drops a beat. Not only will it help clear your skin, make your cycle shortened and predictable, and soothe the fetal position in bed all day cramping that is hereditary in your family, it will also help prevent you from forcing me to raise a grandchild. I firmly believe every woman should have complete control over her body, as well as the comforting knowledge of when it is safe to wear white pants. 4. Be a kid and like it. While I will help you understand the natural evolution of womanhood by putting you on the pill, sharing my makeup, teaching you to shave, and buying you one sensible thong, I demand you embrace your girlhood while you are in it. When I was 14, I spent my lunch breaks challenging friends to spirited games of duel monsters, or arguing why Vegeta was clearly the superior Saiyan. Now, I assume most teenage girls spend this time posting their boobs to Instagram. Be the girl who plays tag with the boys, and not the one supplying handies behind the bleachers. Be the girl who can confidently wear asexual sweatpants and Chuck Taylors, and not the preteen in clothes so short and tight, a passerby would have no trouble describing her fallopian tubes to a police sketch artist. Don't rush to be an adult. Just enjoy being a kid for as long as you can. Because once you are not a kid, you have to open a bank account, buy prophylactics without blushing, and get approved for your own cell phone plan. 5. Never fit in. Your mother can be Googled alongside the phrase ass shots, so understand you are never truly going to fit in among your classmates. But who the hell cares? The desire to fit in is basically resigning oneself to the comfort of inferiority. It may feel safe to be a face among the crowd, to have someone else dictate your style and attitude, but it takes guts to stand out. Be your own leader. Set your own standards of what is cool and beautiful. Make people follow you. 6. Have some selfie respect. My darling daughter, if you would ever like to take a selfie, please wait until after I am dead. 90% of selfies posted online are silent screams for the world to give the affirmation withholding parents never did. We get it, ladies. Daddy didn't hug you enough, and with each let-me-come-on-em-titties tweet a 40-year-old living in his mother's basement sends you, that hole in your heart is slowly filled. But despite my general disdain for an act so oxymoronically vain and insecure at the exact same time, I will admit that there are rare occasions when it is perfectly acceptable to take a selfie. While standing in front of a national monument, when using your phone's camera to check if your makeup is holding up and your hand slips and accidentally takes a picture. As a polite time saver, after you get the permission of a celebrity who is clearly in a rush. When at dinner with a friend, but there are no strangers around who look trustworthy enough to hold your phone without trying to steal it. Helpful hint, just ask the waiter. If you are really trying to sneak a pic of someone behind you and don't want to make it obvious you're a creep. If a dog is sleeping adorably atop you and you don't want to wake it up. When taking a pic of you and your significant other kissing, those are actually adorable. Helpful hint, these are only cute when showing them to your friends or as a 5x7 photo taped to a dresser's mirror. Posting these pictures on social media is an awkward invasion of your relationship's intimacy. I feel like people with fulfilling, genuinely happy relationships don't have to keep reminding the world. You'd save time by just tweeting, I pray every second this penis doesn't leave me. Hashtag blessed. When you've had your makeup professionally done and you want to try to recreate it yourself later, but will inevitably fail and just make yourself look like a hooker who had a really profitable day. If you are Mindy Kaling or Anna Kendrick, who can do no wrong. When showing off a delectable dessert, helpful hint, completely social media approved. Everyone wants to see the pure joy on the face of a person who is about to eat a donut the size of his or her torso. When you want to show your guy your freshly salon-styled hair or super flattering outfit to help fester his insecurity about how hot you look when he's not around. If someone else is holding the phone, the shame is now theirs. If you can 100% guarantee the intention of your selfie is not a desperate cry for strangers to help make you feel pretty, but truly an act of harmless arrogance. Anyone so self-confident, so genuinely proud of her own image she feels the overwhelming desire to share it, deserves to take a selfie. If she is 18 or older, no one likes Instagram jailbait. 7. Always bring a sweater. Self-explanatory. It would also be a good idea to make sure the following are either on your person or only a short panic sprint away. Tampons, travel-size deodorant, gum, an inhaler, as you are sure to inherit my asthma, a fully charged Nintendo 3DS, there will never not be a new Pokemon, and a condom. 8. Ew, gross, my mom just said condom. Yeah, I know. You don't want to associate the word sex with the person who cuts the crust off your PB&J. But guess what? Your parents are goddamn bunny rabbits. How do you think you were accidentally created in the first place? Nevertheless, I promise to educate you about safe sex the second you unroll your first poster of, insert your version of Angel from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I want sex to be something you and I can openly talk about. I want you to be smart and knowledgeable of your lady labyrinth and not just assume babies are made when a bird and a bee love each other very, very much. Note to self, Lady Labyrinth, possible name of all-girl rock band. I would also appreciate if you try to be a virgin until you get your PhD. But just in case, it is my job to teach you to respect your body, to make only the choices you feel comfortable with, to help you understand that 92.3% of guys will give a detailed play-by-play of how far he gets with you to his garbage man if he's willing to listen, and to provide you with condoms behind your father's back. 9. Unconditional. No matter how much you fuck up or how badly you behave, I promise to always be your best friend and confidant. I will accept you for who you are and provide you with a safe, loving home for as long as I live. 10. On one condition. If you ever own a single piece of Breakfast at Tiffany's or Marilyn Monroe basic-ass paraphernalia, I rescind number 9. I realize there's a chance my future offspring may be a boy. Here is the list of essential information you, my dear son, should know. 1. Morning boners are perfectly normal. 2. Try not to be an asshole. 3. Be good to women. They deal with way more shit than you do. Chapter 10. Hello, Sunshine. No one ever tells you what happens after Happily Ever After. The book gets shut, or the credits roll, and we're just supposed to assume that when the hero of the story gets exactly what they want, the story is over. But when you finally cross the finish line, slay the dragon, marry the prince, reach the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, when you actually get a hold of whatever the hell it is you've been chasing like mad, there is only one thought that will cross your mind. What now? I folded the aqua blue quilt twice over so it would hopefully be thick enough to prevent my ass from falling asleep this time. After placing it on the freshly steamed carpet, I plopped myself cross-legged atop it. In my new apartment in the Sunshine State, this quilt dutifully served as my only piece of furniture for quite some time. It was my living room couch when I used my laptop to watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia DVDs. It was my office chair every time I stole my neighbor's Wi-Fi to check my email. And when I wrapped myself in it like a human burrito, it was my bed. I was training at Florida Championship Wrestling, FCW, as a member of the WWE's developmental talent roster. And even though the expensive transition of living on my own in another state meant I would have to get by without a car or furniture that wasn't made of faux down feathers for a while, I was perfectly content. I was adamant about saving as much of my weekly checks as I could. I knew money to be a fleeting thing, and if I could survive just fine without a proper mattress, then I wasn't going to overextend my wallet chain to get one. Even if there were only Hot Pockets and Little Debbie's honey buns in my refrigerator, at least it wasn't empty. In fact, it almost felt like a grandiose splurge when I sprang for the pizza rolls, too. Nutrition was a lost concept to me at this point. I had survived on less before, knowing I had finally entered a real career, my dream career, made me feel like this was just a part of earning my stripes. As I sat on the lumpy quilt, I opened a spiral notebook across my lap and uncapped my pen as if I were unsheathing a sword. Pen and paper were my weapons before my body ever learned to be, and it was comforting to return to the white and blue lines to plan my next moves. For a decade, I had a singular mission, to make it to the WWE, to become a professional wrestler. I had done that. I had accomplished what had at times seemed unattainable. But what was I going to do now? I couldn't rest on my laurels and be satisfied with simply making it. When you finally live out your biggest dream, the next step must always be dream bigger. On a blank sheet of paper, I wrote my 10-year life plan in giant letters. Visualization is important to me. I believe that imagining yourself in agonizing detail in whatever dream life you want is the first step in getting there. Writing the words was a way for me to stare at my desires and be held accountable for bringing them into the world. Here is what was hastily scribbled onto the page in hopes of willing the words into fruition. My 10-year life plan. 1. make it to the main roster. 2. Win the championship. 3. Have an action figure made in my likeness, but with exaggerated body measurements. 4. Be in a video game. 5. Be on a pay-per-view poster. 6. Find a haircut that hides my 5-head. 7. Have my own merchandise. 8. Have a match at WrestleMania. 9. Write an autobiography. 10. Adopt more dogs. It was a lofty list, but it was also non-negotiable, except maybe for the haircut, as long as stylists were incapable of magic. I knew what dreams I wanted to chase next, and even if they seemed impossible to reach, that only made me want them more. My dreams were the hot girl in high school, and I was going to convince them to go to prom with me, and then maybe get them pregnant so they were stuck with me forever. The realist in me, the tiny voice I regularly beat into submission, knew that this was not going to be easy. I had scored a contract, and though that felt like the end of a long road, I knew it was only the beginning. Ahead of me was a high hill to climb. I would have to train hard and perfect my craft in order to be noticed among the 50 other developmental talents, some already having waited years for a promotion that had yet to come. The developmental roster, though spending most of every day collaborating and depending on one another while training and performing on shows, were in direct competition. If the writers and producers needed a new character for one of the two main roster television shows, Raw or SmackDown, they would pick whoever they thought was the most polished and prepared for superstardom. But sometimes a promotion would be given to a wrestler who wasn't entirely ready for the road, but had the look higher-ups were interested in. Essentially, it was a crapshoot. All we could do to control our own destiny was to make ourselves the best wrestlers and performers we could be, and be prepared when the opportunity presented itself. Though there's always the option of kicking in opportunity's door like it owes you rent money. It almost felt like we were doctors on call. Horror stories floated around the training facility of wrestlers getting phone calls at midnight and being asked to pack a bag and jump on the first flight at 6 o'clock that morning. In a whirlwind experience, they would travel to whatever city the show was taping in as the main roster traveled to 5 different cities across the country each week. They would perform in the ring for agents and had a shot at debuting on television that night. Everyone wanted that call, but at the same time feared it. Should the worst-case scenario happen? No one wanted to get in front of agents and be turned down, depressingly sent back to FCW to train for who knows how much longer. Some of the wrestlers had experienced the rejection several times, totaling anywhere from 2 to 5 years within the developmental system. Suddenly, I realized why everyone in FCW seemed tired, dejected, and not nearly as naively bright-eyed as I had entered. I had worked hard at training in New Jersey, but once I started the rigorous schedule at FCW, I realized what I once thought was hard work was almost laughable in comparison. FCW was not a place you could pop in for 2 hours, have a practice match, and call it a day. We had to eat, breathe, sleep, and bleed training. And I bled a lot. I was now known as AJ Lee. In developmental, we had to choose our own character names, but couldn't use our real ones because the company wanted to own the copyright. I pitched AJ, since it was my family's nickname for me, and Lee, after Wendy Lee, a voice actress in my favorite anime, Cowboy Bebop. Initially, AJ was turned down because the company felt it was too tomboyish, but when legal rejected the rest of my pitched names, and there was only an hour to submit a name to print in our FCW magazine, I got to sneak the name AJ in before anyone noticed. I chose an apartment only a few blocks away from the warehouse we trained in, and each morning I would drag my giant suitcase full of extra clothes, knee pads, elbow pads, and towels down the road in the blazing Florida sun. I would be drenched in sweat before I even got in the ring, which made people really look forward to rolling around with me. A typical day of training started around 8 a.m. The roster would be split into groups and made to run training drills together. Since there were only a handful of women on the roster, we were integrated into drills with the guys. After a few hours, we would be paired off with either a guy or a girl to have a practice match on the fly. For performances on shows, there would normally be a game plan for the match. But in training, it was essential to learn how to adjust in a moment's notice and communicate without letting the audience know. We would then practice promos and study old matches. 3 evenings a week, we would travel around Florida and put on ticketed shows. If there wasn't a show that evening, we would be allowed to go home around 5 p.m. But trying to expedite the training process and get to the main roster, I started staying until 8 p.m. to squeeze in extra practice. 2 new signees, Javille, a fitness competitor who had won the Arnold Classic, and Trinity, a dancer with insane natural athletic ability, would eventually join me after hours. Our little crew of rookies was looked after by Tom Pritchard, Norman Smiley, or Billy Kidman, former wrestlers and now trainers with the patience of saints and an apparent death wish. They would let us keep the lights on in the building for as late as we liked and were brave enough to let us use their bodies as crash test dummies. We beat the everlasting gobstopper of shit out of them during hours they were not even getting paid to work. A great teacher is selfless, and they just wanted to see their students who had enough fire to spend an entire day in a humid warehouse succeed. I would drag my suitcase home, wash my annihilated workout gear, eat dinner on my quilt, ice my entire body, and fall asleep watching DVDs. In the morning, I would peel myself off the floor and do it all again. Day in and day out, every second not sleeping or eating was spent either in the ring or watching tape, trying to perfect every facet of the art form. So deep within the grind, I began to literally dream of performing in the ring. The nightmare was always the same. I was pushed through a curtain in front of an audience of thousands, but I didn't have time to put on any of my wrestling gear, so I would be forced to wrestle in whatever my cruel subconscious decided to torture me with. A sundress, pajamas, laundry day underwear. There was rarely a moment my mind was on anything else. Inevitably, there were growing pains, and I mean that quite literally. Through a new rigorous weightlifting regime and healthy diet, now made possible through a growing bank account, I gained 10 pounds of muscle. My body quickly transformed from a stick figure to a stick figure with teeny tiny guns. Naturally, I invested in several tank tops. But just to make sure I wasn't getting too confident about my body, it began to fail on me as often as it could. I suffered 2 more concussions, a dislocated elbow, 2 dislocated kneecaps, herniated discs in my thoracic spine, and a charming hole in my face. During an intergender tag team match, I dove out of the ring and onto an awaiting Javille, who was standing arms outstretched on the ground below. She was so concerned about my safety in landing, she wrapped her arms tightly around my waist, and the snuggle made my mouth connect with her forehead. Pulling away, I noticed a gash on her dome and freaked when I realized my tooth had somehow scarred her face. I freaked even further when I realized that my determined snaggletooth had actually punctured through my own face to get to hers. The bottom half of my face was quickly drenched with the warm blood I couldn't help but dribble out. For the rest of the 15-minute match, I poked my tongue through the hole above my lip to freak out the children sitting in the front row. After the show, Javille drove me to the emergency room, where I spent the night waiting to get my face stitched. I got a cab directly from the ER to the airport to fly out for my first shows with the main roster. Every time I look in the mirror and see that little scar above my lip, I remember carefully chewing my airport dinner/breakfast burrito on one side of my mouth, and then falling asleep across 3 chairs at my gate while still clutching the wrapper. The days began to bleed into one another. Before I knew it, months had passed, and I was no longer the rookie on the female roster. So many women had come and gone through the system that somehow I was the female wrestler with the most experience. It was a strange adjustment. I was used to looking to others for guidance, and seemingly overnight, I was given the responsibility of the locker room leader. As a sort of passing of the torch, in early 2010, I won the title of Queen of FCW in a taping of our local cable show. Up until that point, it was the greatest match of my career, and came with a distinguished perk of having to balance a small plastic crown on my giant lollipop head during every show. The group of girls I spent my days with in developmental were smart, tough, and eager to learn. Watching them blossom into full-fledged performers made me beam with a mama's pride. Not only was I growing as a wrestler by leaps and bounds, I was helping shape the future of the main roster's women. It was a hell of an honor. My trainers began to put so much faith in me as a leader that for the next 5 years, almost every woman who had a tryout with the company had her tryout match with me. Agents would even ask my opinion of the potential of the girls in the ring and their personalities in the locker room. As much as I loved being trusted with that responsibility, I was essentially putting my body on the line in situations where I would never see most of these women again. A lot of wonderful, experienced indie wrestlers came through tryouts, but a ton of ladies who were getting into the ring for the first time got to learn the ropes using my 110 pounds of bony might. Along the way, I realized that I was being treated like a utility man. In wrestling, that is a person who is well-rounded enough to be counted on to make their opponent look good and help them learn. I was old, reliable, and though that was flattering, that meant I would probably never get out of FCW. I would be used as the person to help more exciting and more beautiful women graduate to superstardom. I don't think anyone looked at me and saw a potential star. A year and a half had passed. I had been brought on the road a few times, but was always sent back down. I bought some glue and glitter to decorate my pity party hat. I would never let depression grab a hold of me the way it had before, but being bipolar means experiencing emotions to an extraordinary degree. So when I began to feel down, to lose faith in myself, it hit me hard. Living alone for the first time while doubting my own potential made for an isolating experience. Living in a new state, working at a new job, not knowing if I would ever make it up our corporate ladder, made me feel very small and very alone. Some people seek out relationships to avoid seclusion, but I liked being single. I had a lot of practice and considered myself a professional. What I did miss, oddly enough, was having someone to look after. I wanted to take my mind off the 24/7 pressure without getting gonorrhea. I was stressed and in need of someone to talk to, preferably someone who did not talk back. I thought of Muggsy. It often felt like the only time I knew what unconditional love could mean was when his fat ass curled up in my lap and made me sing him to sleep. Muggsy was now in Puerto Rico with my parents, but maybe it was time for a new rescue pup. I felt prepared for it. I'd finally rescued myself, so why not share the wealth? Ultimately, I wanted to feel useful, like I was doing more in the world than waiting for someone else to decide my fate. And so, I began chiseling away at my 10-year plan. I found myself scrolling through the website of my local Humane Society. I lit up when I saw that a litter of pit bull puppies had just entered the shelter. Pit bulls were my absolute favorite breed, and I secretly hoped I could find one that had a head as large as Muggsy's. And so I visited my local shelter, the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, to check out these pups. Upon arriving, I filled out an application to visit with a litter of pits and impatiently hung out in the waiting room. As I looked around, I noticed all 7 visitors were waiting on meeting the adorable pups. After my initial competitive instinct to beat everyone in the competition for these dogs' hearts subsided, I felt tremendous guilt. This building was full of older dogs, lying on the cold floor of a cage as every visitor passed them by to play with the shiny new puppies. I figured it couldn't hurt to at least stroll through the rows of cages and see if any other little guys would catch my eye. My barometer for human decency is to see if someone can make eye contact with a shelter animal and not immediately turn into goo. Within seconds, I was bawling as I looked at the innocent, hopeful eyes, wondering if I was going to be the person to bring them somewhere warm and safe. And then I noticed the one dog that wasn't rushing toward the gate of his cage. A small blonde chihuahua wearing a bright blue turtleneck lay shaking in a ball inside of his food bowl. Sure, dogs look adorable when dressed in clothes or as inanimate objects like when a wiener dog wears buns, but morally, I'm against this. No, lady, your dog does not love wearing that dumbass tutu. It's not a human baby. It's better than a baby because you do not have to teach it the English language or how to hold a sippy cup, and it will never grow up and talk back. Upon further inspection, however, I found out this chihuahua had to be covered up because the building was chilly, and he was balding. The paperwork attached to his cage labeled him as a special adoption, requiring extra care from an attentive, committed owner who would be willing to administer his 6 different medications. Not only did he have kennel cough, a sick stomach that inhibited his eating and made him underweight, and a knee injury, but he had a skin disorder that caused his hair to fall out, presumably permanently. Basically, he was a winner. The volunteers at the shelter told me he lay inside of his bowl because he felt safer being surrounded, and normally he was not very social. He mistrusted all humans after surviving several harrowing ordeals. The chihuahua exhibited strong signs of abuse and had been turned into a kill shelter in another state when animal control found him limping in the street. The shelter discovered he was microchipped and contacted his registered owners to let them know they found their pup. But it became clear when they refused to come pick him up, the owners were the ones who had hurt him and left him out on the street. He spent a month in the kill shelter, and when it reached maximum capacity, he was put on the euthanization list. And that is when the world's truest superheroes, the animal shelter volunteers, stepped in. The government will provide funding for a shelter if it regularly euthanizes its animals to help clear up the homeless pet population. If an organization wants to be a non-kill shelter, it must rely on donations and volunteers to operate. With limited resources, they do their best to visit and assess the behavior of animals who are closest to being euthanized at government-funded facilities, and then will transfer the best candidates for adoption to the safety of their shelter. They may stick around the shelter for months, but at least they have a shot at life. This chihuahua was one of the lucky few brought into the safety of the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. But no one was interested in taking home a sickly, bald chihuahua. This poor little guy was unwanted, unloved, abused, and alone in the world. Having been homeless, incarcerated, and placed on death row, he clearly had enough street cred to make a rap album. He was a survivor. I delicately reached through the bars of his cage and scratched at his rough head. "Are you my tiny furry soulmate?" I asked while he lifted his head and gently inspected the hand petting him. I got lost in his giant, watery eyes. He stood up in the bowl, and I was sure this was a sign that he had indeed chosen me too. And then he proceeded to puke all over my hand. I'll take that as a yes. Strolling through a pet supply store with the newly christened Nacho Cheese Mendez was an eye-opening experience. Customers looked at the meek little man the same way people look at homeless people in the street, with a sad look of sympathy before quickly averting their eyes to avoid being rude. Or maybe they just thought I had stolen a half-eaten rat from the snake tanks. I had removed Nacho's blue sweater, and though he was visibly relieved, the bald patches on his body were now exposed to uneasy passers-by. One customer, shopping with a beautiful, fluffy, golden retriever puppy, actually directed a pitying, "bless your heart," my way. An employee told me he thought Nacho's skin condition looked permanent, and I should consider some cute outfits to cover him up. I clutched tighter onto my wonderful little freak and whispered to him, "I think you're perfect just the way you are." Though pet store employees and even some veterinarians doubted Nacho could blossom into a healthy, beautiful flower, after months of medication and TLC, that's exactly what he did. He was my very own puppy Chia pet, growing all his glorious, fluffy fur back and shaking off the harsh memories of his past. His indomitable spirit and tenacity were inspiring. If Nacho Cheese could overcome the odds, so could I. And as if he knew, I had a new companion to carry the torch of looking after me and providing an unwavering source of unconditional love. Muggsy began to let go. "I don't think he has long left," Dad warned me as I entered the farmhouse in Puerto Rico during Christmas vacation. I had 2 weeks off the nonstop schedule each year to visit family during the holidays. I would not be able to travel back to Puerto Rico for another 12 months. I hesitantly entered the bedroom Muggsy spent most of his day inside. On a small mattress, he stayed lying on his side even as I approached. In my mind, Muggsy was still the hulking brute of his youth, but he was an old man now. My eyes always had to adjust to the withering sight of him. Having once been a ball of vibrant energy, he now couldn't find the strength to lift his head. I watched his thinning tail lazily smack the soft surface as he wagged upon realizing who I was. My little guy, my beautiful chunky monkey. He had been through so much as part of the Mendez clan. Though my father rescued him from a life of violence, he ended up on every harrowing journey we endured. When we lost our home, so did he. When we slept in a car, he was right there, curled up in my lap. He shared a couch on a screened-in porch and a mattress in a motel room. When I feared the danger of our neighborhoods, he was at my side to make me feel safe. He was never a dog. He was a member of the Mendez family. And I could see in his eyes he would be gone soon. Stroking his now rough fur, I knew he wouldn't make it to the next Christmas. His breathing was labored as he noticed my lap and tried to prop himself up to sit on it. But he was too tired. And so I lay down beside him on the mattress, wrapped my arm around his warm belly, and sang to him for the last time. "You are my sunshine, my only sunshine." Chapter 11. No one wants to have sex with you. Purgatory is a place in Tampa, Florida. It had been almost 2 years since I first stepped foot in FCW, and though in some ways I was living a completely new life, it also felt like I was running in place. On the one hand, things had never been better. Not counting the sciatica, the stitches in my mouth, or the need for brain medication to avoid punching strangers in the face, I was healthy. Finally educating myself about nutrition, and making enough money to buy more than one avocado at Whole Foods, my out-of-shape stomach had tightened into what almost resembled an ab. I could finally afford to buy furniture, which was now covered in Nacho's newly grown and surprisingly abundant fur. And I had moved Erica to Florida to live with me after she had outgrown our small town in New Jersey and or burned an ex-boyfriend's house to the ground and needed to lie low for a while. But on the other calloused hand, progression through the wrestling ranks was painfully slow. For 2 years, I had spent every waking hour training in one form or another. Occasionally, I would see a glimmer of light when I'd get an invite to travel with the main roster. However, at the time, when a female wrestler went on the road for a trial period, it was only in a hosting capacity on untelevised events. While the guys got to have matches on the house shows, smaller arena shows where wrestlers and producers would try out ideas for the TV programming, the women would host a fan trivia question or dance contest. Women had more opportunities in speaking, character, valet roles than in the ring during this era. So we hopefuls had to first demonstrate we could be bubbly and charming before we would get our chance. The host was only required to do 2 things, wear a dress and speak to the audience without stammering. 1 out of 2 would have to do. I didn't own any dresses at the time, so when I got my first phone call to travel on house shows, I rushed to the one store I depended on for all my clothing needs, Burlington Coat Factory. This was years before I would start making Target clothes money. All of the women on the roster consistently stunned in skin-tight designer dresses, but I knew that, A, I couldn't pull those off, B, I didn't want to flash my vagina to an audience of thousands just yet. And C, I could buy an Xbox and two games for the same price as one of those fancy dresses. After pillaging the bargain racks at Burlington, I finally found a dress that fit my prepubescent frame. Sure, it was a child's medium, but buying it would get me $5 off a KitchenAid toaster, and I couldn't resist such a deal. Pairing the dress with the kitten-heeled shoes one of the girls in SCW had sweetly bought for me at a thrift store, I really thought I cleaned up well. For about 5 minutes. When I walked backstage in a half-sequined, half-floral-patterned shift dress that resembled an art project a 5-year-old would make out of curtains she inherited from her dead grandmother, I was met with perplexed eyes. A sexpot I was not. One of the wrestlers walked up to me, put his hand on my shoulder, looked deep into my eyes, and said, "You look really good." He then busted out laughing when he thought he walked out of earshot. I had no clue how to style myself, let alone walk in even the smallest of heels, so when the time came for my inaugural walk through an official WWE curtain, I stumbled in front of the crowd, looking like a baby deer on ice, who was somehow also drunk and pregnant. As I steadied myself, I realized an audience of thousands was quietly staring at me, awaiting something charming to fall from my trembling mouth. I had never been in front of so many people, let alone had their undivided attention and a microphone in hand. It occurred to me that nothing was really stopping me from violently shouting, "Douchebag balls!" into the mic, besides a desire to not be fired, even though it would make a hell of a story. Customarily, the host would welcome the city by name before picking a child in the audience to answer her trivia question. A kid who answered right would get to sit ringside for the upcoming women's match, which for a long while had involved lots of hair pulling, prop balls, and at least 2 spanking spots. So it was important to pick a child young enough to hit puberty on the spot, or at the very least, return to the child's parents with a lot of uncomfortable questions. As I opened my mouth to welcome the crowd, I suddenly forgot where we were. The crippling stage fright that came over me made it impossible to remember which city we were in, but I had already begun making unintelligible sounds into the live microphone, and couldn't turn back now. Hello, guys? I was off to a great start. How is everything going tonight? A question as exciting and personable as some weather we're having, huh? But at least I stopped making guttural noises. Who likes trivia? I asked, like a second-grade substitute teacher. When the child I called on was too young to form words, the second child I forced the microphone on answered incorrectly. Well, shit, no one prepared me for what I was supposed to do if the damn kid got the question wrong. Instead of saying anything, anything at all, into the mic, I just turned to the ring announcer, Tony Chimmel, and nervously shook my head. He was kind enough to bail me out and let the kids sit ringside anyway. At least, I assume so. I had already kicked my heels off and hauled ass behind the curtain before I could spontaneously combust. Normally, our trainers at FCW would receive reports on our performances while traveling on the main shows, and I was sure my first would be the death of my career. It was tragic, but not for the reason I had anticipated. Sitting in the trainer's office in Tampa, Tom Pritchard tried to gently break the news to me. "This is not a big deal, but I wanted to give you a heads up on something," he warned as I braced myself for the scathing review. "I just want to say that I personally think you're one of our best female wrestlers here. It's just that sometimes that's not enough. Have you considered repackaging your appearance?" Wait, what now? I had Hindenburged my first hosting gig, and the only feedback I was getting was about my looks. They didn't like your dress. They said it looked a little conservative, matronly. He was visibly uncomfortable, so I tried to help ease his mind by yelling, "Matronly? I swear it was from the kids' department at Burlington. I wasn't helping. I just thought you should know. And personally, I'm not saying it's right, but it would probably be a good idea to start practicing makeup and all that other girl shit. I just don't want our bosses to walk in here and see all your dolled up competition and look right over you because you're wearing a hoodie. He was undoubtedly relaying the message of my superiors softer than they had intended, but it still stung worse than that time I fell into a red anthill on the farm in Puerto Rico. As a host on house shows, a woman's purpose was to look stunning and act fun and flirty so the audience would remain entertained in between matches. And I couldn't do either. I wasn't a good fit for the job. I was naturally unkempt, and even when I tried my hardest to doll up, I still looked homely. So it made sense when I wasn't invited back on the road the next week. I was getting far on skill alone, and had secretly hoped I could help change the minds of WWE executives into thinking that was enough. But to be fair, this was still a business. A business that had a successful formula when it came to their women. And I wasn't going to change that overnight. It takes time to start a rebellion. This was my face and body when I got signed. But now the pressure was on for me to change. The question was no longer, what makes a good girl? It was, what makes a girl good enough? And whatever that was, body, hair, or looks, I apparently wasn't enough. But when I got inside of that ring, people paid attention. They cheered for me because they related to me. They felt connected to me and shared my pain and didn't give a crap that my eyeliner wasn't straight or my body was that of an athletic preteen boy. I needed to make my bosses understand this. They needed to see it in action. But it was hard to grab their attention when I was a singular voice in a crowd. I wasn't going to have an army supporting my cause. I had to become a one-girl revolution. A few weeks later, I was surprisingly brought back on the road. The last time, I had tried to mimic what I had seen before me and essentially just came off as a shitty version of a hot chick. I was not going to out-sexy the rest of the female roster, so I had to find whatever it was I did best and embrace that. And what I did best was wear sensible shoes. Luckily, success is when opportunity meets preparation. The first night on the two-night house show loop, I asked a fan a trivia question. The kid got it right this time, and my work for the evening was done. I sat ringside with the fan for the women's match that followed my segment. It went gut-wrenchingly bad. I know how hard females in the industry work to be respected, and when a match does not go well, it hurts all of us. Mostly because the decision-makers felt it was only proving their point, that a woman's time in the ring should be limited. On television, the women's matches were a meager 2 to 3 minutes, compared with 15 to 25 for the guys. So watching the ladies crash and burn that evening made me feel genuinely sorry for them. One of the top guys, a phrase to describe main event wrestlers who are such attractions, they sell the most merchandise, garner the highest TV ratings, and are essentially considered the reason fans buy tickets, was vocally disappointed with a match. And when I say vocally, I mean he threw a water bottle at the backstage monitor while the match was on the screen, breaking the expensive TV set, and yelled at the producers, "Get some fucking talented women wrestlers on this show, please." When I got backstage, the show's producer, Fit Finley, immediately pulled me aside. "I hope you have your gear on you, because you're wrestling tomorrow night." "What? Yes, okay. Why?" I was a cornucopia of emotions. "You can thank CM Punk for that one. He's got a hell of an arm," Fit laughed while walking off. The next night, I had my first official WWE match, and it was everything I had ever dreamed. Not only was I wrestling with the main roster for the first time, it was in a match for the women's title against the champion, Layla. Layla was always helpful and welcoming and was generous enough to let me shine in the match. She played the bad guy heel role to perfection and knew letting the babyface have exciting moments only made her character seem even more dastardly when she shut them down with dirty-handed methods. I appreciated her generosity and willingness to let me have my moment, since it could potentially lead to a full-time spot on the roster. The match went off without a hitch. It was fast-paced, exciting, and far exceeded any match I had up until then. Even more overwhelming was the fact that the crowd was uncharacteristically loud for a women's match. Every guy on the roster congratulated the two of us. Even the douche nozzle who made fun of my dress a few weeks earlier shook my hand out of respect, and Fit pulled us into an office to let us know he would put the match on a DVD for us to remember this significant moment. He let me know he would put in a good word for me on the road and hoped he'd see me again soon. It felt like a dream, like a cheesy sports movie where a player gets called off the dugout and scores the game-winning hoop. I don't know sports. All I knew was that I had been waiting 2 years to get a shot at proving my mettle in the ring. I stumbled into an opportunity, and I made the most of it. I could feel the good juju vibrating in the air, and I hoped my call-up would be imminent. And it was. A week later, I was brought to the television tapings, and my debut was written into the SmackDown's first draft.
First drafts change, you say? Nonsense.
I was scheduled to debut alongside Vicky Guerrero and Dolph Ziggler, whose characters were phenomenal villains and something of an item. The plan was my character would lead Dolph astray and cause a rift between them. Upon hearing the news, I found a custodian's closet backstage and cried tears of joy inside of it for 15 minutes. I also applied my makeup and got changed in the closet because I was too nervous to enter the female locker room. An hour before showtime, I was still waiting to see a script or talk to a producer who could let me know what to expect. Ed Koski, the show's head writer, was nice enough to break the news gently.
So, some stuff got shuffled around in the script, and your debut is not going to happen tonight, but definitely next week, okay?
He tried to soften the blow and keep my hopes up, but I was devastated.
Next week. I'll just wait till next week.
I locked myself in my unofficial dressing room and opened a roll of toilet paper resting next to a dirty mop, proceeding to cry off my sloppily applied mascara. Next week never came. But a few months later, FCW's female roster got a pleasant surprise. The Sci-Fi Network had aired 2 seasons of a competition-based show featuring the men of FCW. Each season, a winner had been picked and given a spot on the roster. It was a new way to debut in the main shows. Season 3 had not been picked up by the network, but their contract with WWE required them to air a few more episodes of the show. So it was decided these 4 weeks of airtime would be given to the women of FCW. The rest of the competition would be aired on the company's website. It was a step down from the previous seasons, but we were all still pretty stoked to find out we would be filming alongside the main roster and traveling around the country. I was happy to have a change of scenery from FCW, but frankly a little disappointed. I had spent 2 years competing to earn a spot on the main roster, and a debut was tantalizingly dangled just out of reach. Now I would have to compete all over again for the opportunity that had just been written out of a SmackDown script. It was a frustrating step back, but at least I would have more opportunities to show my worth. At least we would get the chance to show what we could do in the ring, that we were capable and strong women, that we were here to take our rightful spot and be respected. So, inevitably, the first contest on the show was a dance-off. There was also a chocolate-eating contest, a limbo contest, a present-unwrapping contest, and a sumo wrestling contest, complete with blow-up fat suit. It's possible we weren't being taken entirely seriously. But when there was a sliver of a chance at proving myself, I took it. On WWE history contests, I smoked my competitors, displaying my knowledge and respect of the business. I had learned to handle the mic a lot better than I had as a host, as I finally felt like I had something worthwhile to say. My promos and attitude began to garner a following. The fans were ready for a change. And the 5-foot-nothing nerd in Chuck Taylors, instead of wrestling boots, was giving them an option. During the first season 3 episode of NXT, a writer and producer actually went through all the other contestants' luggage to help find me something suitable to wear, after deeming what I had on not fancy enough for television. Layla, with the best of intentions, even helped me find heels and unsuccessfully tried to stuff my bra. And so for episode 2, I hid from sight until a minute before showtime and emerged in what I had wanted to wear the first week. Knee-high Chuck Taylor sneakers and a loose-fitting dress. I was scolded after the show, but it was too late. Fans had taken notice of what at the time was blasphemous style for a woman in the company. Women in the WWE were meant to wear expensive, tight-fitting dresses and high heels. They were glamorous sex kittens. Alongside a group of smoking hot Barbies, I looked like Lil Sis Skipper. But suddenly, I noticed an influx of girls proudly sharing their pictures on Twitter of them honoring the style. Chucks with dresses. Chucks with I Heart Nerds shirts. I knew I had something there. While everyone was concerned about being appealing to our male fan base, it seemed they were neglecting their fellow females. I realized that was who we as women should be targeting. They made up almost half our fan base, but didn't have someone they could see themselves in. I would be their reflection on the TV screen or computer monitor. I would get them to join an uprising. I would find a way to succeed by using the things I had been told would hold me back. A few weeks into the 13-week competition, I was called into the office of a member of talent relations. In essence, this man was one of my bosses, underneath only the owners of the company, so I assumed this was not going to be a chat about the weather. I stared at my intertwined fingers fidgeting in my lap as I racked my brain trying to figure out who I pissed off. Was it one of the veteran guys whose hand I forgot to shake? Had the head office found out about that speeding ticket? Had somebody seen me eat 5 chocolate chip cookies in catering? "Don't look so nervous. I promise you're not in trouble," he said, trying to quell my obvious unease. "I just wanted to talk to you about our Diva brand. How well do you think you're fitting into that brand?" Diva was the name of the Federation's women, while Superstar was the term used for men. Battles have been waged over the discrepancy between the two. "Well, honestly, I'm not trying to fit in, and I think that's working for me. You guys have told me I get the most fan votes every week, so I think that means they're connecting to the message I'm trying to send." The NXT competition held weekly eliminations in order to crown a winner. Who moved on in the competition was determined by fan votes and an expert panel, aka the higher-ups in the company. I knew just winning the fans over was only half of the work, but I figured if my bosses could see the reaction I was getting, it would help them to see me favorably. "And what message is that?" He was obviously not expecting that response, but he was willing to see where I was going with this. "That wrestling matters. That there are a dozen gorgeous women here to choose from if you're looking to put someone on a poster. So why not focus on ring skills and personality? Half our audience is women. I think they want someone to represent them, someone they can get behind. Also, they really like my shoes." This was true. Not just the part about my Chucks being killer, but that I had begun to connect to the fans on a different level. Any chance I got the microphone in my hand, I made sure to distinguish myself from the pack. I had a strategy. Not only did I think it was important to represent myself genuinely, but it just made smart business sense. I remembered that when I was a young girl watching the product, I wasn't into designer dresses and high heels. I watched pro wrestling because I was a tomboy, It reminded me of my video games, and the rough and tumble nature spoke to me more than any fashion magazine or teeny bopper show about high school relationship drama. It made sense to me that women watching years later would probably still skew more toward the down-to-earth variety. I assumed they were tired of their only options for heroines not being